From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. And new numbers from the Labor Department today show nearly 4 million people applied for unemployment benefits last week. That takes the total to more than 30 million who have applied in the last 6 weeks. And in Iowa and Oklahoma, officials are warning laid-off workers that if they don't return to their jobs when the economy reopens, they could lose their unemployment benefits. Meanwhile, here in Los Angeles, all residents, even those without symptoms, will now be able to get free coronavirus testing, according to the mayor, Eric Garcetti. And today, Dr. Anthony Fauci of the White House Coronavirus Task Force told NBC that hundreds of millions of doses of a vaccine could be ready by January.
We're going to safely and carefully, but as quickly as we possibly can, try and get an answer as to whether it works and is safe. And if so, we're going to start ramping up production with the companies involved.
Well, a vaccine would be welcome news everywhere. Let's go to Richmond, Virginia. There have been around 300 cases of the virus and more than a dozen deaths. And this week, the city's health director went out of his way to point out that nearly all of those deaths have been African Americans, even though African Americans only make up half the city's population. Dr. Danny Avula is director of health districts in Richmond and Henrico County, Virginia. Dr. Avula, you made a pretty straight across the board statement there. Nearly all of the deaths have been African American. What else are you saying?
Yeah, it's true. As of last night, 14 out of 15 of the folks who've lost their lives to COVID-19 are African-American in Richmond. And I think probably the most important thing to take away is that the COVID-19 isn't necessarily creating these health disparities, but it definitely is bringing them to the forefront. I mean, it's definitely making them clear. And I think in much of our discussion about COVID-19 from the beginning of this pandemic was recognizing that African-American communities are going to be hit harder by this. They have higher rates of underlying disease, of hypertension, of diabetes, and they also tend to serve in jobs that require them to be out and about more. They've got to get on a bus and go work as a frontline cashier at a Walmart or as a custodian at an essential business. And that's going to put them at higher risk to actually contract COVID-19, which is going to bring COVID-19 into their community and have more dire results.
Well, according to the COVID tracking project, Virginia ranks near the bottom compared to other U.S. states in terms of tests done. Now, we know your House Minority Leader there, Todd Gilbert, who's a Republican, has called on Governor Ralph Northam to explain that. But meantime, you've begun a free testing program. But, you know, there's concern, and we're reading in The Washington Post about the Tuskegee trap. We know this well. African-Americans were tracked by researchers, not given treatment for their syphilis, and so there's been a distrust. Is that part of what you're dealing with, that you may have citizens who don't trust, well, you and what you represent?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and it's not just Tuskegee. It's decades and centuries of that kind of exploitation and dehumanization of African Americans in this country. And so this has been a long part of the Black community's story with both healthcare and with government. And so as we have really attempted to increase testing opportunities in minority low-income communities, in part that's been met with gratitude, but in part that's been met with resistance. You know, we very early on saw social media posts going around saying, hey, don't come into our community, telling their residents, don't get tested. The health department is going to do experiments on you. They're going to give you COVID-19. We don't need to be anybody's guinea pigs. So, you know, those sentiments are things that we understand. We understand the social and cultural context around Black communities. And so we expected that to some degree. And thankfully, in Richmond, we've had a long relationship with public housing residents. We hire residents of public housing as community health workers. We have on-the-ground clinics in all of 8 of our large low-income communities in the city. So we are continuing to be there, to come alongside, to offer testing, recognizing that not everybody is going to want that.
You have the platform. Say what you'd like to say right now to the residents in your city of Richmond and the county.
Yeah, I think that we understand that this is couched in a long history, and we hope that you see it for what it is, which is really increasing access to testing for communities who haven't had it. And the importance of that is that African-American communities are going to feel this disease harder than other communities. And so knowing if you're positive or not will help you protect the most vulnerable residents of your community. And we hope that if you have symptoms or if you have concerns about exposure, that you will get tested.
That's Dr. Danny Avula, Director of Health Districts in Richmond and Henrico County, Virginia. Dr. Avula, thank you, and we wish you all the best.
Thanks so much, Robin.
We're seeing horrific images of the toll the pandemic is taking around the world, and that includes Ecuador, where bodies have piled up in the streets. Among Latin American countries, only Brazil has more infections and deaths. Our next guest is watching what's happening in Ecuador closely. Debbie Mucarcel Powell is a Democratic congresswoman from Miami. She was born in Ecuador, and she joins us now. Congresswoman, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you, Tanya.
You're actually from the hardest hit parts of Ecuador, and we've seen those devastating pictures of bodies in the streets because the morgues are full. It really is terrible. This has to be extremely distressing to see.
Yes, Tanya. And, you know, it's been heartbreaking. And it's also, there's a feeling of helplessness from my side, because even though I was born in Guayaquil, and I have family, I have friends, and thank goodness they're safe, they're healthy, they have been following the guidelines of staying at home and social distancing. I have a district here in Miami-Dade County and Monroe County where I have thousands and thousands of people that are in desperate need for assistance. We have the highest rate of cases of COVID-19 in the entire state. So the feeling of helplessness that I have to focus first on my community here in Florida, but knowing that Guayaquil and the people that I know in Ecuador have been asking for help has been heartbreaking.
Yes. And tell us a little bit more about what's happening there. I mean, we know how relentless this disease can be, but can you shed light on why this is happening? Is the pandemic just too much for Ecuador's healthcare system?
Yes. When you start in a country, it's a developing country. We had Correa, who really depleted the reserves in Ecuador, and Lenin Moreno, the current president, came in just trying to start from zero, trying to build credibility in the world. He's traveled to the United States, where Ecuador has a history of a very close relationship with the U.S., but under Correa, the relationship was broken. So trying to build credibility, trying to bring investments into the country, trying to build that health infrastructure, and then to be hit by this pandemic, the country was just not ready. And imagine with a community that has a high level of poverty. In Guayaquil, it's a highly populated, dense city. It's a port city. There's a lot of travel in and out of Guayaquil. And they suspect that the cases came in from Ecuadorians that had been living in Europe or had been traveling to Europe. And when they came in, it just took them aback. They were not prepared. And when you have these areas where they don't have access to fresh water for them to wash their hands, they don't have access to a hospital, to a doctor, the virus spread very quickly, and they didn't have the infrastructure to support the spread of COVID.
You mentioned just the devastation of the coronavirus where you are. Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida announced this plan to reopen some businesses on Monday. That excludes some of the hardest hit areas like yours, like Miami-Dade. But do you think that that's a good idea?
We have so many problems right now in the state of Florida. Like I mentioned earlier, Miami-Dade County we are the epicenter of COVID-19. We are close to 12,000 cases. We have surpassed 300 deaths in the county, and we don't have the information whether that's an accurate count or not. There are people that have not received any sort of relief through their unemployment request. The state has failed in many instances. They failed to close down public spaces early on, and that's why we've seen such a high rise in cases. I think that any plan to reopen in the state of Florida is premature. It's irresponsible. We have not hit our peak in many places here in the state of Florida. And we don't have the testing kits that we need at this time to understand how many people have this virus and be able to also have that contact trace in place before we can safely, slowly start reopening our economy here in the state of Florida.
Are there any steps to make that happen? We know that other states have received an influx of test kits. Is that anywhere in the near future for Florida?
So the problem is that there has been such a block in communication with the governor's office. They have time and time again assured us that we would have enough test kits, that they had the supplies that they needed. But then I get calls from different elected officials in my district saying that they don't have enough test kits. Now, we just passed in Congress last week the emergency relief bill, including an additional $25 billion to expand test kits. The problem has been that we have not seen that national coordination. There really has been a huge failure by the administration and also our governor. We need better, and I know that we can do better. And it's taken some of our congressional delegation to coordinate amongst ourselves to provide the equipment, the test kits, and just the information and the resources for our communities.
Congresswoman Debbie Mucarcel Powell is a Democrat from Miami, talking about her home country of Ecuador and Miami, devastated by the coronavirus. Congresswoman, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Tanya.
So what do we know? What do we know about remdesivir, a possible treatment for COVID-19, about beach closings or openings, about how many more people will die? We have so many questions, and we've been bringing in experts for answers. And today I'm going to fangirl a little here because we have longtime New York Times science writer Donald McNeil, who's dedicated his life to providing accurate information about outbreaks, including AIDS, Ebola, SARS. He's now one of the leading voices of reason and science on the coronavirus. We've been planning to talk for a while. What a perfect moment. Donald McNeil, welcome.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
And let's start with the antiviral drug remdesivir. Data from a government study shows it reduced recovery time for people in a trial group from 15 days to 11 days. We know Anthony Fauci yesterday went out of his way to say how significant this was. Proof a drug can block this virus. Does that mean it keeps COVID-19 from getting progressively worse in a patient?
Hopefully. Remember, this was a trial that was unblinded midway in the trial, and the effect was big enough so that you have to change the course of the trial and offer everybody who's on placebo the drug. But it does not mean that it's a miracle drug. This is sort of like a little bit better than Tamiflu does when you use that for for influenza. It shortens the course of the illness, but it's not like, you know, antibiotics used to be that were literally like Lazarus drugs that let you get up out of your bed, and or like HIV drugs were in the early days when people who were at death's door were suddenly pulled back. It gives you more of a fighting chance. We're still looking for a drug that's a real antiviral cure that really targets the virus and wipes it out. So this isn't it yet.
It's taken intravenously. It's not a pill that you can pop. You have to be in the hospital for it. But might it be like AZT was for HIV, a story you were very involved covering, in that it might become part of a cocktail?
Possibly, yes. I'm more optimistic about monoclonal antibodies. Mm-hmm. Experts I talk to are more optimistic about monoclonal antibodies, that we will eventually figure out which antibodies are the right ones that really neutralize this virus. We'll be able to grow those in cell cultures and inject them into people. And that should give some quite strong protection for a while, for as long as those antibodies last. Mm. And then if you can get it into enough people, you can sort of drive the virus out of existence. But that's not going to happen anytime soon, because it takes a while to first find the antibodies and then find a way to splice them into a virus that can grow, and then grow a lot of them and then infuse them into people.
But just for a second, when you say remdesivir stops COVID-19 sooner, in this virus in particular, I'm thinking that might be a little more important, because we're hearing how people seem to be getting well and then they get worse. And I'm wondering if you can stop it before they mysteriously turn that corner.
You don't always know where you are in the progress of the disease. We haven't really got the system working in the United States the way we should. I mean, we now have people recuperating at home if they have mild disease. And that's actually quite dangerous policy. And it's something they don't do in China or in Asia, because they know people can crash. So when you're at home, you can infect your family, as Chris Cuomo did. And also you can crash. And if your healthcare system is overwhelmed, you may not get an ambulance for an hour or two, when normally, you know, you get an ambulance in 6 to 8 minutes in New York City. So in China, they would have you recuperate in a center with a lot of other people with mild cases so that they could catch the crashing ones. We've tended to put people like that in hotels, and that's a bad idea, because some of them died alone in their rooms because nobody was there
exactly
to catch them.
I think, 4 or 5 in New York City in a short period of time.
Yeah, it's a dumb policy. Yeah. They're not learning from the all these lessons are to be learned from overseas, and they're not learning them. They're not looking hard enough at what other countries have done.
Well, Donald McNeil, pick something else out that U.S. officials aren't seeing in your mind.
Well, I mean, look, our states are coming out of lockdown way before. If they were in other countries, they would be coming out of lockdown. I mean, China didn't bring any of its cities out of lockdown until they had zero new cases for 14 days, which is the incubation period of the virus. So that meant you were pretty darn sure you'd wiped out the virus in your city. That way, once you come out, you can quickly jump on any spread and do contact tracing. But if you have several hundred cases still in your city, here we're saying we want to see cases. In other countries, they would say we want those cases gone for 14 days. That's how you stay on top of the virus. So we're doomed to this sort of hammer and dance sawtooth kind of next 2 years, where we're going to come out of hiding and try to get the economy started again. But then, you know, everything will look quiet for a couple of weeks, but then cases are going to start to go up. And depending on how you detect those cases, it might be through fevers using the Kinza app. It might be through positive tests. It might be through hospital admissions, which is, if you get to the point where you're having to detect cases by hospital admissions or deaths, your surveillance system is really not good enough.
You mentioned the Kinza app. I just want to jump in. This is the Kinza Smart Thermometer. We'll post a story on that, which is uploading the data from its thermometers so that it can see where hotspots are across the country, even before the CDC.
Yes. I've written about this app for 3 years because I thought it was brilliant. I've watched them, and I've watched the way the CDC tracks flu seasons, and I've realized that they saw the same trends in flu across the country, but they saw them at least 2 weeks, sometimes 3 weeks before the CDC did.
Well, so, Donald McNeil, I think you were just pretty straightforward, but I'm going to ask you to be even more so. Florida is opening up all but 3 counties, parks, outdoor seating at restaurants, beaches. You're saying that's a deadly mistake.
I think it's going to be. I'm careful about predicting the future, but if you can't be sure where your cases are, they can spread quite a bit. I mean, we know in New York City that cases were probably spreading as early as February, and we didn't catch it until all of a sudden we got the tests in mid-March, and by that time we were in this horrible situation where we then had, you know, thousands of people die. This is learning to do surveillance the hard way by using your citizens as guinea pigs. I don't think this is a smart move for any politician. I know they're under a great deal of pressure to get businesses back to work, but the virus is no longer just in cities like New York and New Orleans now. It's in Appalachia. It's in southern Utah. It's in northern Maine. It's in really remote regions of the country. And if they open up and get people back into too much contact with each other without knowing where the virus is spreading until the emergency rooms get busy, people are going to pay for that with their lives.
How do you think it's spreading? We had that new report recently, including one in the journal Nature, saying, you know, we knew in the past that these were big droplets that would land on things, which is why you had to clean all these surfaces. And we know that we're wearing masks to keep whatever we have in, but it may not keep those big droplets out unless it's a, you know, very professional mask, which is why we stay far away from each other. But now there's reporting that the virus may be tiny, little flecks of it that may be suspended in the air and aerosolized. Your thoughts on that?
Well, it looks like that is the case because there have been cases where people have been infected. There are a number of studies where people are infected many feet away. There was an interesting study from China where you see where one diner sat during a meal, and he not only infected everybody at the table, but he infected people 15 feet away at the next table on the opposite side of the table and people 15 feet behind him. And he didn't get up and cough in anybody's face. You know, measles transmits this way. It's not that the virus is floating alone in the air. It's that you can get enough virus into a tiny droplet to start an infection. So we have basically zero defenses against it so that it can trigger an infection through that. And that's quite worrisome. And the other thing that's quite worrisome is it's very clear that there are a lot of asymptomatic carriers. And those carriers are singing, breathing, coughing, speaking. It's much more dangerous indoors because the air is still indoors and those particles hang in the air. Outdoors, they basically blow away.
Yeah. There's been talk of certificates proving you're immune. And that goes back to the testing for antibodies. After somebody's recovered, they might have the antibodies showing that they fought it off safely. But then we thought there was debate about whether or not antibodies, you know, you can have an antibody for a couple of years for a cold coronavirus, and then it wears off, and a couple of years later, you can still get that cold coronavirus. So do you think the antibodies is an absolute proof that you're immune?
I think we don't know yet. Normally, when you have IgG antibodies, which are the second group of antibodies, your body has these IgM antibodies that sort of sit around, kind of generic antibodies that attack anything foreign. And then your immune system learns the shape of the thing it's attacking, and the T cells and B cells, which are types of white blood cells, produce another set of antibodies called IgG antibodies. Now, those are usually specific, but we don't know what level of antibodies you need in order to be protected. We don't know if you need both those antibodies plus the primed cells, which is called cellular immunity. We haven't figured out what it is and how long the protection lasts. So once we figure that out, and it may mean that you have something more complicated than a simple finger prick test in order to figure that out. I mean, as Tony Fauci says, with almost every disease, getting the disease and recovering from it gives you some immunity. I remember my daughter had a classmate in her class in kindergarten who got chickenpox twice, and that's theoretically unheard of, but actually it happens. Some people mount a weak immune response the first time, and then they get chickenpox again. But we don't know yet what creates immunity, what titer of antibodies, how primed the cells have to be. Once we figure that out, I'm sure there will be a lot of people who are immune and will be able to issue certificates. And I hope they aren't written certificates, because then you can just hand it to somebody else. I hope it's something that, you know, a chip under your skin or an app on your cell phone that is attached to your face and your fingerprint so that it can't be switched with others. We need to do something secure so that people who are not immune are not going out and posing as immune.
Yeah,
and getting sick.
Yeah. In a different America. Look, we're going to link people to your article the year ahead. It has some of your coronavirus predictions, including that many more Americans are going to die than the White House is saying. It's killing more than 2,000 Americans a day, more than heart disease or cancer. But I just, a couple
many
things.
Americans
first of all,
have already died that more than the White House predicted. They predicted 60,000. We crossed that yesterday or the day before yesterday. Now that the same model they use says 74. But that model ends on August 4th. There's no prediction for beyond that. I mean, if we go out and behave like we did back in February, we'll be back on the path to 2 million. As the White House admitted, we were on the path to before.
We have to stop, sadly. New York Times veteran science writer Donald McNeil. This is his beat, pandemics. Donald, look forward to having you back again at some point. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And with most kids out of school, a big challenge for educators has been the millions of kids who don't have quality internet. For many teachers and administrators, the biggest fear isn't lost learning, it's losing contact with their students. So they're going back to some old-fashioned communication tools. NPR's Alyssa Nadworny reports.
When school closed in Fall Creek, Wisconsin, a small rural town up north, school district staff got an unusual message. Don't give assignments or quizzes. Just do this one thing.
I want you to call people and I want you to ask them two questions. How are you doing and do you need anything? That's all I want.
That's Joe Sanfilippe, the superintendent. For him, connection was the most important thing.
We're not even talking about an internet connection. We're talking about making sure that they're connected to an adult in the building.
So Sanfilippe and his staff got to work on calls.
Hello?
Hey, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Oh, not doing too bad for a week.
Calls like this are happening across the country as schools and districts face the reality that not all students and families are connected to the internet, despite often massive efforts to get them hooked up. In so many places, schools are the most trusted source of information in a community. They offer resources and food and are a link to services. The internet, which we often think of as a tool for learning and academics, is far more about human connection.
There's magic in phone calls. There's magic in personal touch.
Chad Geston is the superintendent of the high school district in Phoenix, Arizona. Unlike Fall Creek, Wisconsin, which is a small rural district with about 800 students, Phoenix is a major city. They, too, have worked hard to get their families connected to the internet. But the digital divide is real. So Geston and his team have pledged to call every student, all 28,000 of them.
If we want to connect with 100% of our youth, that most of that will have to happen over the phone.
So they assigned every adult in the district, the bus drivers, the teachers, the coaches, the support staff, even the superintendent, a list of students to call. The goal is to call every day.
Maybe it's an AM call. Maybe it's a PM call. Maybe it's a lunchtime call. These are simply calls where we ask questions like, how are you doing today? How's your family doing today? Do you still live in your current residence? Are you worried about rent next week? Do you have food on your table and in your cupboards and in your refrigerator? You know, are your utilities and your electricity still on?
Here's what it sounds like.
Hello.
Hi, my name is Cynthia. I'm a community liaison with Phoenix Union High School District.
What's up, dude? It's Mr. Coburn. Is there anything that I can do for you? Do you need anything?
Hey, I just wanted to call and see how you're doing.
We're just checking in to see if you received your delivery of food items last week.
Yes, we did.
All right, and you know how to get a hold of me if you need anything, right? All right, reach out or I'll talk to you tomorrow. All right, thanks. Bye.
Take care. Give me a call if you need to speak with me. Peace.
All right, thank you so much. Have a good day.
You as well.
Thank you.
The district estimates they've talked to about 20 to 25,000 students. Of course, that means there are still several thousands of kids they haven't reached.
We haven't reached every kid yet. We're trying every day. Numbers are disconnected, and youth aren't answering phone calls. We don't know if that means they're homeless. We don't know if that means they've moved. We don't know if that just means that they no longer have a phone or they no longer have electricity.
Gueston says they aren't giving up. They'll keep trying to call, and they're also doing home visits now, maintaining social distancing, but they're out there, knocking on doors, letting students know that even though school buildings are closed, district staff and teachers are still there with open arms. Alyssa Nadworny, NPR News.
On Friday, tenants throughout the country are expected to participate in rent strikes asking for a national freeze on rents. Some states have already placed moratoriums on evictions and foreclosures during this COVID-19 pandemic, but our next guest says there are still many states offering little to no protections. Emily Benfer of Columbia Law School created the COVID-19 Housing Policy Scoreboard with Princeton's Eviction Lab to track and evaluate each state's housing plans during this pandemic. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, thank you for being here. So you're tracking in real time how states are handling evictions. What are you ranking them on?
So our scorecard illustrates the importance of eviction moratoriums during the pandemic, as well as supporting tenants and property owners in order to prevent mass evictions and homelessness. And so we're looking at five aspects of eviction, foreclosure, and affirmative measures that states are taking to keep people housed. So the first we're asking, does the state bar landlords from providing tenants with notices to quit their apartment and filing an eviction? And so far, we found that only 25% of states have prevented the initiation of the process and the filings. The second stage is the court process. So does the court actually suspend eviction hearings or stay judgments by the court or toll deadlines? And this is where the majority of the eviction moratoriums are happening, where 45% of courts across the country have actually suspended hearings and 25% have stayed orders of evictions. And then the third category is the enforcement of an eviction order. So does the state prevent sheriffs from enforcing an eviction order for non-payment of rent or otherwise? And 36% of states and territories have frozen this enforcement aspect. And then the last categories that we're following are really the short-term supports and how to keep tenants in their homes during and after the pandemic.
I want to talk a little bit more deeply about that, but I also want to ask what states, based on your criteria, are providing some of the more comprehensive protections for renters.
The states with the most protective measures are really focused on stopping the eviction from happening in the first place. So at the very initiation stage, and then also providing tenancy preservation measures to keep and support tenants in their homes. The states that are really at the top of the scorecard, so Massachusetts, Delaware, and Connecticut, have done both of these things. Just over a week ago, Massachusetts passed model legislation that actually froze all phases of eviction. And this is important because we know that the mere filing of an eviction can result in a scarlet E that drops credit scores and impacts housing options in the future.
I want to ask you, though, a little bit more about Massachusetts, because some advocates are telling us they saw a rise in motions to evict. How is that happening, and what exactly does that mean?
So despite federal and state eviction moratoriums, evictions actually remain widespread across the country. Before Massachusetts and even Connecticut adopted some of these most protective COVID-19 housing policies, Landlords collectively had filed over 1,100 evictions in the span of 1 month in just those two states. In other states, we're seeing landlords resorting to self-help evictions by changing the locks or removing door frames, employing other tactics to push tenants out and circumvent the law.
What is the incentive for a landlord right now in the middle of this pandemic to actually evict someone?
Well, at this point, they still need to be able to pay their own mortgages. And unfortunately, the federal moratorium on foreclosures does not extend to all properties. So we're lacking coverage for both tenants and property owners. And when we have these large numbers of mom and pop property owners and landlords, it's going to be very hard for them to make ends meet for their own families and to keep their businesses open if they're not also receiving rent payments.
What states are you most worried about and why? We know that many places, as you just laid out for us, have not passed much legislation, if any at all.
We're very concerned about the states that are moving forward with evictions, and especially those that have backslid a little bit. So Idaho and North Dakota and Alaska recently lifted what were somewhat protective moratoriums on eviction to remote hearings and lifting those earlier bans. So to address this feared avalanche of cases when society reopens, states are beginning to replace these court-ordered eviction freezes with remote hearings. And this is problematic because under these pandemic circumstances, prematurely lifting eviction moratoriums before the housing supports are in place will have unintended consequences well beyond increased housing instability and unpaid property tax payments and societal costs.
You argue that housing policy is health policy, that is really at the heart of our COVID-19 response. Can you explain?
Absolutely. It is widely recognized that one's zip code is more indicative of health than genetic code. There is strong evidence characterizing housing's relationship to health. Housing stability, quality, safety, and affordability all affect health outcomes, as do environmental and social characteristics of neighborhoods. In turn, foreclosure, housing instability, homelessness, these have always been pathways to poor health and high healthcare expenditures, from respiratory distress to depression to early drug use to teen pregnancy. The lack of stable and safe housing disrupts everything: employment, social networks, education, social services, and it sets children back emotionally and academically as an adverse childhood experience.
What do you anticipate will happen nationwide after COVID-19 passes?
Property owners ultimately will be unable to carry the missed rent, and we will see a dramatic increase in evictions. This will have a direct impact on local and national economies and significant societal costs. When rent payments decline, so too does everything else in our community. The United States has a dark history of repeatedly infringing on the rights of low-income communities and traditionally marginalized populations. As we begin to reopen America, we have an unparalleled opportunity to rebalance. And we can start by forestalling evictions and including the right of a decent home as central to what it means to be American.
That's Emily Benfer. She's a professor at Columbia Law School and creator of the COVID-19 Housing Policy Scoreboard with Princeton's Eviction Lab. Emily, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's go to a state where advocates say this crisis is growing. Ohio is one of those states where landlords can start eviction if a tenant is 3 or more days late on rent. Joy Forey of Bedford, Ohio, says she was living in a rental apartment for more than a decade when she received an eviction notice in mid-March. This all came as she had just lost her job and asked for a rental extension from her landlord. Joy, you notified your landlord that you'd be late on your March rent, and then what happened?
Once I notified the property manager, told me that there would be no concessions due to COVID-19. And so what that means is that I would be charged $10 a day until I pay my rent. And if they have to file an eviction, it would be an additional $300. And I would still continue to be charged the $10 per day until the court date.
What had been your history with this rental company? Had you ever been late prior?
Yes, I have been late prior. But I have paid all my fees and they accepted my rent. You know, clearly if I'm still living here, you know, they accepted my late fees and everything. But, you know, I don't have a company and I'm a low-key tenant. I don't cause a lot of problems. Don't have a lot of repairs, you know, to my apartment. I mean, it's me and my 7-year-old daughter.
You are still in this home. You received some help to pay your April and May rent from the Northeast Ohio Coalition for the Homeless. Do you plan to continue to stay despite receiving this eviction notice?
Right now, they kind of got my hands tied because we are in the middle of a pandemic. So there's no one, you know, showing apartments. If I didn't have the fees, you know, that they were assessing, there is no way that I'm going to have a brand new startup for, you know, first month and last month's rent. And then in addition to that, I have not received unemployment yet. So, you know, I'm a little nervous and I just don't believe that right now I should be fearful of, you know, me and my 7-year-old being put out.
That's Joy Forey of Bedford, Ohio. And we reached out to the property company Millennium Management, and a spokesperson told us Joy's eviction has now been resolved and that they allowed her to pay her full rent without the added late fees. They would not further comment on their eviction process at this time.
The CDC has renewed its calls for a kind of social distancing for pets after a pug in North Carolina tested positive for the coronavirus this week. It's believed to be the first case of the virus in a dog in the U.S., and along with news last week that two cats in New York had contracted the virus, we have some questions about COVID-19 in pets. And here to help answer them is Will Sander. He's Assistant Professor of Preventative Medicine and Public Health at the University of Illinois College of Veterinary Medicine. So, Dr. Sander, Professor, start with Winston, this pug in North Carolina. The family that owns the dog had three people who also tested positive. We saw Winston on TV. He didn't look very well. You know, he had symptoms. Is it safe to assume that he got this from the humans?
That's certainly the prevailing thought right now, and that's what the evidence is really pointing to. We've had a couple dogs test positive in Hong Kong as well about a month ago. And again, those were both dogs that had owners that were positive for COVID-19.
And we should say that they had two other family pets, another pug and a cat. They tested negative. Why would one pug get sick? And pugs have respiratory issues anyway. They've got those flat up noses, mm-hmm. You know. Why would one get the virus and another wouldn't?
So again, I think a lot of it's there's still a bit of unknown factors around this. And so we know that if it's in the environment, it's possible that pets can pick it up, especially when they're in close contact with their owners, you know, their family members, just like all of us, and we love our pets. And so it depends just like on people. Not every person is going to get sick with COVID-19, even if they get in contact with someone who has it. So it can be pretty individual dependent.
Well, I'm going to jump in to say they're actually not like family members. They're more because we don't lick family members' faces or let them lick ours or, you know, just kiss their noses until they can't stand it. I mean, we actually are more, in some ways, maybe more physical with animals. Is that something, what would you recommend that people do knowing that animals can get COVID-19 and get sick?
Yeah, it's very true. I mean, we, you know, pets have undying love for us. So it's really fun for us and great for us to have that bond with them. And so I think the recommendations that CDC's put out there are good recommendations. And so if you are having respiratory signs, having a fever, tested positive for COVID-19, then you should try and distance yourself from your pets, wear a mask around them, wash your hands before and after touching or handling them. You know, don't kiss them while you're sick. I think those are great recommendations. The best recommendation is if you have somebody else in your house who can take care of your pet for you while you're sick, that would be the best guidance right now.
Oh, that's going to be a tough call for a lot of people because they love having their pets around. But on the other hand, they want them well. But on the other hand, doctor, if this was so contagious to animals, wouldn't we have a lot of sick dogs and cats, not just Winston, you know, who was coughing and having trouble breathing? Wouldn't we have a lot more?
We would, Robin. I think that's a great point. So we have, you know, over 3 million cases worldwide and over 1 million now in the U.S., and we only have now 6 pets, period, across the globe that have been diagnosed positive with COVID-19. So it's certainly not a rampant problem. The risk is very small for us to transmit it to them and non-existent for them to transmit it back to us. So again, we should more often than not take comfort in our pets and not be afraid that we're going to either cause them harm or that they will spread something to us.
On the other hand, again, if somebody has a dog or a cat that's, you know, coughing a little, and you know, remember the big cats at the zoo who are diagnosed, it may not be a hairball. I mean, should you be taking animals in? We're all, you know, so many of us under lockdown, but should you be taking animals in now with maybe more concern that they might have it?
I wouldn't be afraid to take animals in. If they have a cough or something develops, you know, veterinary clinics are still open around the country. We're considered essential service in most states. And so call up your veterinarian, talk to them on the phone before bringing your pet in, but talk through that. There's lots of other things that can cause coughing and sneezing and a runny nose in our pets.
Yeah. And by the way, you say we've not seen transmission from animal to human, except, of course, in what most researchers think was how the COVID-19 started, which was in a so-called wet market where animals are sold to eat. And that's where it's thought the coronavirus was born. So it was from an animal.
Correct. We do think this is a zoonotic disease or one that jumps from animals to people and likely came from a bat, but we don't have confirmation of that. But the hardest part for a virus like this to jump is going from one species to another. And so to have it go from a bat to a person and then for one of our pets to pick it up and then to pass it back to us, that's quite a few jumps to happen. So that becomes progressively more difficult biologically.
Will Sander, Assistant Professor of Preventative Medicine and Public Health at the University of Illinois College of Veterinary Medicine. Dr. Sander, thank you so much because this has raised quite a few alarms. So thank you.
You're welcome. And keep your pets close as long as you're not sick.
Just don't lick them.